view of Longley and the other airborne officers, this meant the abandonment of the conventional rules of what constituted a proper drop zone for paratroopers. They would simply have to be dropped all over the fortified camp, regardless of barbed wire, gun positions, and radio aerials. This was to become the object of an incredibly bitter procedural fight between the combat commanders at Dien Bien Phu and the paratroop bureaucrats in Hanoi, notably the commander of the Airborne Replacement Command, Colonel Sauvagnac. To the end, Sauvagnac insisted on properly established DZs to be used only by properly qualified paratroopers with the requisite amount of training jumps. On the other hand, Longley insisted that basically a parachute was just a handy way of getting out of an aircraft in mid-air and could be used by any reasonably agile man who had jumped off a streetcar. Longley turned out to be right. The most critical attack of the day came late at night. At 2200, the 312th Division renewed its attack on unfortunate Huguette 7, whose star-shaped layout had long since disappeared under the pockmarks of communist and French artillery. At 2330, the second prong of the attack by the 312th Division clamped onto Huguette 6. If both H-6 and H-7 cracked, Dien Bien Phu would lose control of its airfield. Having failed to achieve swift victory on the Five Hills, Giap was now determined to attain it by destroying Dien Bien Phu's lifeline. The battle for the Huguettes was about to begin. On April 1st, Dien Bien Phu had expended 4,500 artillery shells. Most of the ammunition dropped that day fell into enemy lines, and 25% of the air resupply missions aborted. The improved weather permitted the French Air Force and Navy to fly 99 combat missions. Friday, April 2nd, 1954. As the night progressed, enemy pressure on the northern Huguettes also increased. A deserter from the communist side, incredibly enough, there were a few Viet Minh who still believed in the possibility of a French victory, had told the French that rumors had been going around his outfit that if the French held until April 15th, the Viet Minh would give up its attempt to crush them. Yet the evidence was that Giap was trying to be sure that he would not have to keep that promise. By 0400, swarms of enemy infantry were inside H-7. This time, the Viet Minh artillery made sure that they would not again fall into another trap. All French battery positions came under intense enemy fire, and the Viet Minh Bộ Đội saw to it that no French infantrymen would be left over in the dugouts to offer resistance. But in bitter hand-to-hand fighting, Lieutenant Sposio's mixed-bag company of foreign legionnaires, Vietnamese, and Thai held out throughout the night in one of the corner bunkers against the full weight of more than two communist battalions. In spite of the heavy communist artillery fire, Major Clemenceau had ordered Captain Bizarre to break through to H-7 with whatever troops he could scrape together. These amounted to two platoons of the 1st Company, 5th BPBN, and one remaining platoon of 4th Company, 12REI, which was pulled off H-1 while passing through. Accompanied by three of the now badly damaged tanks of the wounded Carrette, commanded by Sergeant Bousseret, the small band of 100 men began to dog-trot across the seemingly endless plain west of the airfield. It touched base on hard-pressed H-6, which could still fend for itself, and then pushed on to flaming H-7. There the situation was desperate. On one corner of the position, one could still hear the throaty staccato of some French automatic weapons, countered by the sharp blasts of Viet Minh recoilless rifles. Yet once more, the psychological shock value of the tanks and the legionnaires did the trick. The enemy infantry began to fall back, and, much to their own surprise, the French remained in possession of H-7. Lieutenant Huguenin, the deputy of Sposio, had disappeared, but in the last remaining bunker, there was Sposio, seriously wounded, with 13 survivors and 3 dead men. Nothing was changed by this small victory. The abandoned hills of Amery 1 and 2, now bristling with enemy recoilless rifles and mortars, were still looking down the throat of Huguette 7, which was now so completely plowed under that it would have to be reconstructed under enemy fire and supplied with endless transfusions of infantry. But there was simply no infantry around for that purpose. From the results of the previous night's airdrop, which had finally yielded 4 miserable sticks of paratroopers from the 2-1 RCP, it would have been suicidal to attempt to provide enough replacements to feed both the Battle of the Five Hills and that of the Huguettes. Agonizing as the choice was, Longley made a decision to abandon H-7 at 0805. the survivors withdrew with their remaining weapons. One platoon was left behind as additional reinforcement on H2. Bizar returned to the main position by noon. The first round of the battle for the Huguettes had gone to the Viet Minh. The communists were also doing well in the artillery battle. At 08:45, Dien Bien Phu reported to Hanoi that the gun crews at both Isabel and Dien Bien Phu had been decimated, and that the French Air Force and Navy fighters would have to take over counter-battery fire against the communist artillery positions near Beatrice. By then, there were exactly 4 serviceable 105s left at Isabel and 8 at Dien Bien Phu. After 72 hours of continuous fighting, their gun crews were in a catatonic state. To be sure, the artillerymen had trained a few of the infantrymen around them in the use of the field pieces, but they could not hope to replace the dying and wounded gunnery officers and non-coms who were being wiped out like flies in their open pits. On Elion 2, Luciani's mixed crew of Moroccans, Legionnaires, and paratroopers was still grimly gnawing away at the communist toehold on the Champs-Élysées. French artillery had finally found its mark on the communist firebase on Old Baldy, and Bijar released the major part of the 1st BEP for a head-on attack down the middle of E2, while French combat aircraft, including napalm-laden C-119s, successfully interdicted D-1, D-2, and E-1. As night fell, E-2 was almost entirely in French hands, and what remained of the communist infantry was back in the ravines between Phony Mountain and Old Baldy, being pounded by the French artillery. But the price of that victory had again been heavy. The 1st BEP had lost 13 dead, 9 missing, and 23 wounded, including its battalion commander, Major Giraud. His job was now taken over by Captain François Vieux. The 6th BPC was down to 50% of its strength. With the French back in their original position, communist artillery commenced an intensive bombardment of E2. Caught in the open in the badly disorganized positions they had just retaken, the paratroopers again had to fall back at 19:30 as communist infantry once more began to seep over the eastern slope of E2. Finally, at 22:30, the enemy artillery lifted off E2, but the methodical gnawing of the Viet Minh infantry continued. At 18:30, as night fell, the troop transports of Operation Banjo reappeared in the sky over Dien Bien Phu and began their slow dribbling of reinforcements over the airfield. Bulldozers of the engineers had cleared off the aircraft wrecks which had littered the field. Despite the entreaties of Longley that it would be safer to drop the men all over the central position than on the airfield, which the communists kept under continuous fire, paratroop regulations continued to prevail. The result was that the build-up of the 2-1 RCP was agonizingly slow, the more so as absolute priority had to be given to the reconstitution of the decimated artillery crews. 32 men from the 35th Airborne Artillery, led by Lieutenant J.M. Jouteau, jumped into Dien Bien Phu that night, along with 74 reinforcements and 3 equipment bags for 4th Company 2-1 RCP of Lieutenant Soubrigy, which then became strong enough to be installed as a separate unit on E3. A stick of 12 Vietnamese from the battalion apparently was misdropped and was not heard from again. Stick number 11 was misdropped on top of enemy-held Dominique 2, 1,500 meters northeast of the T of the drop zone, and lost all but 3 men. Such errors were unexplainable that night, because the DZ was clearly marked and a Navy privateer had verified the visibility of the markers. But the reason was obvious. Some pilots were more impressed by enemy fire than others. It was clear that it would be impossible to continue the battle with a replacement rate of 50 men a night. In fact, De Castries' staff had calculated that even with a net drop of 100 men a night, Dien Bien Phu could hold out for only another 15 days, even assuming that the enemy would not continuously stay on the offensive. How gratuitous that assumption was shown that very night, as heavy pressure again developed on E2 and then suddenly reached its paroxysm in a large-scale attack on H6. The radio message to Hanoi, sent by the command transmitter at Dien Bien Phu at 02:15, had become so routine that it was not even marked with a special operational priority. Last reserves committed on E2. Saturday, April 3, 1954. The night of April 2nd to 3rd had been arduous on Huguette. Not only was H6 severely attacked, but at 0500, communist infiltrators blew up Bangalore torpedoes in the outer barbed wire of H1. H1 was, for all practical purposes, almost completely encircled by communist trenches. But there was no doubt that the object of the next big communist attack would be H6, with its small garrison of 100 foreign legionnaires under Lieutenant Rostille. If anything, H6 was even more exposed than H7 had been, lying as it did at the end of the completely open runway of the airstrip. For the past 15 days, the small garrison did little else but hang on to its position, counterattacking where it could, and filling in communist feeler trenches, inexorably groping their way forward to the strong point. The garrison of H6 also had the grim example of the fate of H7 right in front of its eyes. At noon, the Viet Minh added to the demoralization of the garrison by a small but neat bit of psychological warfare. Opposite H6, a communist regular stood up under a white flag and informed the French that a short truce would be offered for them to come over and pick up the wounded from the battle for Huguette 7. Master Sergeants Cotionnaire and Sterzing volunteered to go into the communist lines with a group of stretcher-bearers to pick up their comrades. On the communist side, there were indeed 4 stretchers waiting for them, but instead of the expected wounded, they contained bodies of 4 dead men, disfigured beyond recognition. It was perhaps the sight of those disfigured bodies which provided the final psychological shock, for that same afternoon 12 legionnaires from H6 left their weapons behind, crawled through the barbed wire, and deserted to the communist side. There also were minor disasters that day. The 2 water tanks, which until now had provided the garrison with a handy supply of pure drinking water and thus kept intestinal diseases under control, were both pierced by enemy shells, adding to the other physical miseries of the men. At 1925, the communist assault began against H6. Dien Bien Phu immediately requested air intervention to stand by on 30 minutes' notice. The new attack developed on the eastern flank of H6 and at first gained ground fairly rapidly. Long Ley then decided to commit his last preciously hoarded reserve, Captain de Mont's company from the 8th assault on Strongpoint Sparrowhawk. Led by the 3 tanks of Sergeant Ney, the small band sprinted under heavy fire across the bare airfield, caught its breath under the illusory protection of the wreck of the C-47 transport, and slammed into the southeastern flank of the communist spearhead of Division 312. This time, the enemy was caught in the open by superior firepower, and the 3 Bisons had a field day among the disorganized communist infantry. Within 30 minutes, as suddenly as he had come, the enemy began to fall back, pursued by the fire of the tanks. The latter remained, like faithful watchdogs, until late at night. When it was certain that the enemy had no immediate plans for another attack, they and de Mont's paratroopers began the slow march southward. The greatest success of the night was the parachuting of an appreciable segment of Bréchignac's 2-1 RCP. This followed a Homeric exchange of words between Longley and the senior Air Force officer commanding Operation Banjo. At 20:00, the troop transports were flying a holding pattern over Dien Bien Phu, awaiting the slowing down of the battle for H6, and the extinction of the parachute flares which were being dropped in support of the counterattack. The despairing Longley again foresaw only a trickle of the reinforcements if the Air Force insisted upon landing them only on the authorized DZ. The alternative was to ignore airdrop regulations and to dump the men over the central position itself. Longley lit a gasoline barrel as a drop zone marker at the edge of the Nam Yum and told the drop commander to begin the airdrop. When the latter once more objected that the DZ was not according to regulations, Longley simply said, "Mad! You can tell Colonel Sauvignac that I'll take the responsibility for the drop zone violations. Drop those men!" This time, Longley fully prevailed. The bulk of the 2-1 RCP began to land all over the inside of the fortress. Mishaps occurred, of course, but to a far lesser degree than could have been expected. When the airdrops had to stop at dawn, April 4th, 305 men of the 2-1 RCP and 16 equipment bags, that is, the bulk of the headquarters and headquarters company, 3rd company, and 1/2 of 2nd company, had safely landed inside Dien Bien Phu. Total casualties were 2 dead from enemy gunfire and 10 wounded, most of whom had only minor jump injuries. The battalion commander, Major Bréchignac, himself landed in the barbed wire near Longley's dugout and joined the latter after having abandoned his trousers in the wire. His deputy, Captain Kladik, fell north of Sparrowhawk in front of Lieutenant Allaire's mortar company, but not one man was misdropped to the enemy. In addition to the paratroopers, non-parachutist reinforcements needed for the various technical services of the position were also airdropped. On this point, there had been a long and acrimonious debate between Dien Bien Phu and the paratroop bureaucracy in Hanoi. At first, the latter simply refused to parachute anyone who had not gone through the complete cycle of jump training. Long Le held that the fortress would be devoid of radio specialists, artillery gunners, and tank crews by the time Hanoi combed Indochina for men who had the required skills, were qualified for jump training, and who had volunteered for duty at Dien Bien Phu. At first, Long Le's pleas to let unqualified technical personnel jump into the valley fell on deaf ears. But as the battle devoured complete units and specialists of all sorts, it became clear that the Airborne Replacement Training Center was unable to deliver qualified paratroopers in sufficient numbers. The rule requiring qualification jumps was waived. The book went out the window. Moreover, it is a known fact that the second and third parachute jumps are psychologically more difficult than the initial one. The problem of having to jump immediately after parachute training into a flaming valley crisscrossed by machine gun and artillery fire, and from planes buffeted by flak, often resulted in a great number of last-minute jump refusals. As it turned out, the jump casualties among the non-jumpers who hit the silk for the first time above Dien Bien Phu were as low as those among fully qualified paratroopers. A total of 4,277 reinforcements were airdropped into Dien Bien Phu, of whom 3,596 were qualified parachutists and 681 were non-qualified jumpers. The latter had been culled from a pool of 2,594 volunteers, drawn from units all over Vietnam and comprised of 2,048 Europeans, 451 North Africans and Africans, and 95 Vietnamese. At Dien Bien Phu, courage apparently had no nationality. Along with the paratroopers, two young officers from the armored forces, First Lieutenant Adino and Second Lieutenant Mengel, jumped into Dien Bien Phu that night. They replaced the wounded Captain Ebue and Warrant Officer Corrette. Sunday to Monday, April 4th to 5th, 1954. The night was fairly calm, except for some communist patrols roving around Claudine 4 and 5 in the west. Between 0330 and 0530, Major Couton's legionnaires of the 113th Half Brigade fired upon some of the Bodoy in the process of cutting through the barbed wire and drove them off. As dawn broke, the sleepless, bearded defenders of Dien Bien Phu were briefly treated to a spectacle to which they had become unaccustomed for almost a month. The paratroopers of Brezhenyak's 2-1 RCP, fully assembled, standing erect in their still neat camouflage uniforms, field packs rigged as per regulations, impeccably cleaned submachine guns and carbines slung across their chests or over their shoulders, breaking into a long single file as they began their march across the whole camp to their new quarters on Elian 10 and D3. For a brief instant, it seemed as if time itself had stopped. The monsoon rains had lifted, and only a few clouds were hanging around the mountaintops on the edge of the valley. The air was light and dry, and even the communist artillerymen seemed to be taking a rest. And at 1400, there came another piece of good news. The Viet Minh were leaving E2, quietly and deliberately, pulling back into the ravines at the foot of it. The whole hill stank with the sickly smell of death, as 1500 communist and 300 French corpses rotted in the sun. Slowly, French patrols began probing down the Champs-Élysées to the east slope without encountering enemy opposition. But Bijard decided to leave the lower part of E2 a no-man's land, since it would be impossible to garrison it effectively as long as the enemy had its guns dug in on Old Baldy and Phony Mountain. Far to the south, Lieutenant Colonel Longley's garrison on Isabelle had been fighting off strangulation for the last 3 days. It seemed that the Viet Minh were testing the siege techniques which they planned to use later on the main position of Dien Bien Phu. Communist trenches crept slowly toward Isabelle, to be followed by veritable bunkers, which would have to be destroyed by dive bombers or tanks in costly close-in attacks. On April 2nd, Lieutenant Preaud's tank platoon had gone on such an operation, losing Master Sergeant Consiglieri in the process. On April 4th, The three tanks had again smashed into the enemy trench line and destroyed Viet Minh bunkers with point-blank cannon fire. As night fell, the monsoon rains started again with devastating force. Hanoi promptly informed Dien Bien Phu that no personnel drops would be made that night. The 212 remaining troops of 1st and 2nd Companies, 2-1 RCP, would have to spend another 24 hours in Hanoi. However, the enemy had decided not to wait to press home his attack on the decimated garrison of H6. At 20:15, Huguet 1, 5, and 6 reported that they were seriously probed. At 2200, as Long Le returned from dinner with Le Mounier and Badeau via the underground tunnel system which now connected most of the central headquarters dugouts, and which had been appropriately given the name of Metro after the Paris subway, he was informed by Major Clemenceau that Huguet was under heavy artillery fire and that a massive assault against H6 was building up. Indeed it was. The Communist High Command had apparently decided to smash into the French defensive system over the outposts in the valley bottom, where the massive Viet Minh superiority and manpower could be fully brought to bear against the French, and where all French reinforcements would have to run the gauntlet of the open airfield, rather than use the protection of the hill line and the high eastern bank of the Nam Yum. The new attack was entrusted by Le Truong Tan, the commanding general of the 312th People Army Division, to Colonel Tui's 165th Infantry Regiment with its four battalions, reinforced by the 401st Heavy Weapons Company of the 308th Division with its 120mm mortars. In addition, most of the enemy howitzer batteries on the western flank of Dien Bien Phu were now working over the northern part of Huguet and the airfield. What happened during the next few hours on Huguet 6 was a perfect example of what raw courage and determined leadership can do, even in a desperate situation. When the second battle for H6 began, its garrison counted exactly 88 legionnaires and two lieutenants, Rustil, whose tour in Indochina had ended, and his replacement, Lieutenant Francois. Shortly after 2200, it will probably remain forever impossible to retrace fully the exact sequence of events, Clemenceau committed Captain Viard's Composite Intervention Company from the 113 Half Brigade to the help of H6. As the battle developed, the various strongpoint commanders were anxiously listening in on the command net, and thus heard within a few minutes that Viard's small band was being hacked to shreds along with the remaining legionnaires on H6. At 00:30 of April 5th, H6 reported that it was being attacked simultaneously from the west, north, and east, and that its survivors were withdrawing into the southern part of the strongpoint. French reserve units now were thrown in piecemeal as they became available. At 01:15, the Special Air Service Company of the 8th Assault, under Lieutenant Bali, began to move northward inside the airfield drainage ditch, accompanied by tanks Conti and Ettlingen under Lieutenant Mengel. But this time the Viet Minh were prepared for the arrival of the tanks, and a heavy barrage of artillery shells and bazooka rockets greeted their appearance. Nevertheless, they and Bali's weak company kept inching forward and finally reached the southwestern corner of the strongpoint, where the Communists had dug in their forward base of fire. This is where Tank Conti blew up a mine, wounding, among others, the gallant Sergeant Ney, who had led the platoon since the beginning of the battle. Tank Ettlingen also sustained a bazooka hit, but stayed in the fight. Bali split his company in two parts, one of which succeeded in breaking through to the garrison, while the other, with the help of the remaining tank, kept the Viet Minh's mortars temporarily pinned down. It was clear, however, that this was not enough to save the survivors of H6, let alone hold on to the position. At 03:15, the understrength 2nd Company, 2-1 RCP, under Captain Kledik, was committed to the battle. Kledik had arrived at Dien Bien Phu only the day before, but, installed with his men on top of E2, he had been able to survey the battlefield quite thoroughly. Kledik decided to take his men right across Sparrowhawk to the drainage ditch, only to be informed by Bali that further progress along the ditch would be impossible. But Kledik was not going to be pinned down. In one flying leap, he and his company crossed the wide-open airstrip, whose metallic runway plates shone like a mirror in the greenish light of the parachute flares, and rushed head-on into the southernmost Viet Minh elements covering the encircled strongpoint on its southern face. Kledik never gave them the chance to take aim. At 04:20, he closed in with them, and in a vicious hand-to-hand fight mowed them down and broke into the ruins of H6, where about 20 survivors were still holding on to one bunker. Without breaking pace, Cladic's men began to mop up the peripheral trenches of H6. While Cladic had staved off disaster, Longley had called on the indefatigable Bijard to mount one of his instantaneous operations. At 0500, Bijard arrived at Longley's headquarters from Meliant 4 with his deputy, Major Thomas, one intelligence officer, a map officer, and his unit clerk. In less than 1 hour, Bijard had orchestrated a counterattack to be led by 2 companies of his own 6th BPC, with Villiers' 1st BEP standing by in reserve. The French Air Force promised a major effort as soon as the weather permitted it, probably early in the morning. At 0600, the lead company of the 6th BPC, under Lieutenant Lepage, reached the line where the 8th assault had dug in. It was immediately followed by a 2nd company. Considering that both companies together numbered less than 160 men, they could hardly be considered a match for the more than 3,000 Baudois committed to the fight by the other side. Yet they arrived exactly as the enemy committed a 4th battalion, 14-165, to the battle for one last furious counterattack. But he had waited too long. Daylight had come, and the French artillery now began taking a frightful toll of the attackers. As they began to recoil at 0830, the first French fighter bombers appeared in the morning sky and began their deadly carousel over the enemy infantry, caught completely in the open and far away from the protective shelter of the jungle. At 10:15, Cladic and the other junior officers, who were now masters of Huguette 6, surveyed the battlefield around them. There were the bodies of more than 500 dead Viet Minh, many of them perhaps 16 years old or younger, sprawled in grotesque positions inside the ravaged breastworks of Huguette 6. In the barbed wire and minefields around the position, 300 more bodies could be counted, and at least as many wounded must have been taken along by the retreating enemy. 21 communist prisoners, all very young and jabbering from shock, were found among the dead and later on sent to the prisoner of war camp, which Dien Bien Phu still maintained in its midst. The 312th Division, for the time being at least, had lost the use of at least one full regiment. On the French side, the losses had also been very heavy and irreplaceable. Of the 4 small paratroop companies committed during the night, more than 200 men, including 4 officers, had become casualties. Miraculously, Cladic's outfit had suffered less than 10. The foreign legionnaires who had garrisoned H6 had practically ceased to exist. Had Dien Bien Phu's ability to receive reinforcements by air been unimpeded, these losses would have been acceptable. But in the face of a trickle of reinforcements, which, over the whole duration of the battle, averaged only 75 men a night, the losses were extremely serious. French intelligence soon picked up urgent radio messages from General Giap to his own rear services to provide him with replacements from his 25,000-men reserve pool dispersed in well-camouflaged camps throughout North Vietnam. At the same time, messages to Red China were intercepted, requesting delivery to the Viet Minh forces of another flak regiment with 67 guns of 37mm caliber. The second Viet Minh offensive against Dien Bien Phu had been weathered. While the French had won the battle, it had been won at a price in men, equipment, and lost terrain that was to ensure ultimate defeat. As for Lieutenant Colonel Longley, he had directed the battle from Clemenceau's command post on H3, which he had reached in pitch blackness with his jeep, accompanied by Bijard and his small staff. By an effort of iron will, he had abstained from intervening in Bijard's orchestration of the counterattack and had spent part of the night reading a book about the life of a yacht in his beloved home province of Brittany. Escape reading was very much the vogue at Dien Bien Phu. Major Seguin Bazi recalled that he was reading Han Su-yin's famous novel A Many Splendored Thing, alternately with a book on the Korean War. The battle for the Five Hills and the Northern Huguettes had been expensive in other ways. Only 4 tanks now remained in working order at Dien Bien Phu, with 2 more still operating on Isabelle. Moreover, the American 105mm howitzers proved extremely vulnerable to counter-battery fire because their hydraulic recoil mechanisms kept being pierced by shell fragments. Major Alieu's 310 RAC alone found 6 of its 105s disabled during the previous night's battle and had to switch to the far less satisfactory heavy mortars for the support of the infantry. Early in the afternoon of Monday, Lieutenant Minot's company of the 21 RCP reinforced by a platoon from the 8th Assault, replaced Kladik on H-6 while a detachment of disarmed Thai tribesmen and Viet Minh prisoners under Air Force Warrant Officer Le Phon began the grim task of clearing the corpses from the position. In the face of the French successes on Elian and Huguette, another communist probe against the triangle of Huguette's 1, 2, and 5, and aerial photographs now showing communist trenches within 100 meters of Isabelle, could for a time be disregarded. Even the fact that at 1400 a lumbering flying boxcar dumped its whole cargo of 6 tons of storage batteries and 2 75-millimeter recoilless guns into enemy lines was greeted with only mild expressions of disgust. The radio operator at Dien Bien Phu added, "We'll try to destroy it with the artillery and air force." In fact, Dien Bien Phu did better than that. On April 6th, a strong reconnaissance force of foreign legionnaires pushed a full 3 kilometers southward to Ban Co Mai without encountering any enemy resistance except for an observation post where 3 men were killed and entered the deserted village. The force miraculously recovered not only the 2 lost recoilless guns, but also a cargo of fresh human blood still in its refrigerated container. 7. Asphyxiation. The Viet Minh did not consider the battle for the Five Hills and for the Huguettes an unmitigated victory. To be sure, the communist forces were in a far better position to replace their losses at Dien Bien Phu, but General Giap was also concerned with the whole Indochina Peninsula. While Dien Bien Phu absorbed perhaps 5% of the French battle force, including 8 to 10 top-notch battalions, the same battle tied down 50% of the communist forces and an overwhelming share of the military supplies provided by Red China. French intelligence estimates were to show later that of the total of perhaps 23,000 Viet Minh casualties suffered during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, more than 10,000 had been suffered by April 5th. That is, the conquest of the outer hill positions had been terribly expensive and had thus far failed to be decisive. General Giap's own view of the battle clearly indicates that a revision of the tactics for the next siege phase was taking place. "Our offensive on the eastern hills of the central sector has obtained important successes, but had failed to reach all the assigned objectives. We have therefore decided to continue to execute the tasks foreseen for the second phase of our offensive, to advance our attack and encirclement lines, improve our positions, and occupy new ones, progressively tighten further our stranglehold so as to completely intercept reinforcements and supplies, utilizing trenches which have been driven forward until they touch the enemy lines, the tactic of gnawing away at the enemy piecemeal." Every morning, new aerial photographs and maps told the story of this siege technique. A Bearcat reconnaissance fighter from EROM-80 would sweep low over the camp and free drop to De Castri a bag containing special correspondence, mail for the troops, and the newest set of developed and interpreted aerial photographs and maps showing the seemingly unstoppable progress of the enemy's trench system throughout the valley. Tuesday to Friday, April 6th to 9th, 1954. April 6th was a day for stock-taking. The picture that emerged was not a pretty one. Artillery ammunition had shrunk to 371 rounds of 155mm, 7,500 rounds of 105mm, and 1,500 rounds of 120mm mortar shells, or about what Dien Bien Phu's artillery would fire in one night of fairly serious combat. There were no more mines left to put in front of the rear area strong points, such as Huguette 1, or the newly created Lily, carved out of Claudine 1, and a newly dug bunker system between H-4 and Claudine 5. On April 7th, this position was occupied by the remnants of the 1-4 Moroccan rifles of Major Nicolas. There were also no 60mm shells left for the small mortars of the forward infantry units. On the evening of April 6th, the fortress also ran out of flare shells for its 81mm mortars. The despair of the garrison was therefore readily imaginable when yet another flight of C-119s, apparently disoriented by the enemy flak, misdropped its cargo of 18 tons of howitzer ammunition behind communist lines near Ban Co Mai. Another infantry breakout had to be mounted on the following day to collect at least part of it. In fact, the ammunition losses through misdrops had become so heavy that one of Longley's officers suggested deliberately misdropping ammunition packages containing booby-trapped shells. These, upon being loaded into the enemy howitzers, would cause them to explode, which, considering how invulnerable they were to French counter-battery fire, surely would cause them greater casualties than the French artillery and air force together, and might discourage the Viet Minh from reusing misdropped shells. The idea was never accepted by Hanoi, which did not wish to divert scarce supply space to yet another untried experiment. In all likelihood, some of the planners feared that ammunition drops designed to be misdropped would manage to fall with utmost accuracy inside Dien Bien Phu and blow up French artillery pieces. Not counting the sealed-off garrison of Isabel, which on April 3rd totaled 1,613 men, the main garrison at Dien Bien Phu was now reduced to 5 paratroop battalions, none of which, with the exception of the 2-1 RCP, which had received another 177 men on April 5th, had more than 300 men, 2 Foreign Legion battalions with a total of about 600 men, and the unreliable debris of the Thai and North African units for a total of less than 2,600 infantrymen. In fact, this tiny infantry force still held a perimeter almost 10 kilometers in length, and also protected over 1,000 wounded and 2,200 communist prisoners of war held inside the camp. This force also guarded the rats of the Nam Yum, the deserters, and forcibly disarmed Thai mountaineers, to the end of the battle. In addition to lacking good infantrymen, Dien Bien Phu also continued to bleed to death slowly because of the lack of specialists. The battle devoured tank crews, artillery gunners, observers, and radio men at an incredible pace. At 19:30 of April 6th, Dien Bien Phu requested 3 tank commanders, 2 tank gunners, 1 driver, and 1 radio man. Yet even this calm day was not without its minute of excitement, for one very last airplane that day landed at Dien Bien Phu. It was a reconnaissance Morand 500 Cricket of the 23rd Artillery Observation Group based on the Laotian airstrip of Muang Sai, about 120 kilometers southwest of Dien Bien Phu. The tiny aluminum and cloth reconnaissance craft of the 21st and 23rd Observation Groups of French Army Aviation continued to fly the gantlet of enemy flak to provide a minimum of information to the artillery at Dien Bien Phu, which had been without observation posts since the loss of the French hill positions. Since the appearance of the unarmed crickets over the battlefield was usually followed by improved French artillery fire, they had become a priority target for enemy anti-aircraft fire. It was the 21st Group that lost 7 planes at Dien Bien Phu and another 6 through sabotage on March 7th during a daring Viet Minh commando raid on the French air base of Cat Bai. Many of its pilots were now sharing the aircraft of the 23rd Group. Thus, it was Sergeant Pilot Recibier of the 21st Group who was at the controls of Cricket VG and flying with Lieutenant Chouet de la Mestre, an artillery observer for the 23rd. Enemy flak had been particularly quiescent that uneventful afternoon, and perhaps the pilot of the Cricket had become overconfident and had gone lower than he should have. But all of a sudden, the little aircraft found itself framed by the black clouds of communist anti-aircraft fire, followed by the tracer bullets from 50-caliber machine guns. Within a few seconds, Ribière reported that de la Mestre was badly hit and that he would attempt an emergency landing at Dien Bien Phu. Losing altitude rapidly, the little plane plunged earthward almost vertically and began its short landing roll on the southern end of the strip. A rescue crew from the Air Force detachment raced toward the plane in an attempt to save not only the crew but the aircraft, but it was too late. With unerring precision, the communist guns had already switched back to their favorite target and began to hack the little aircraft to shreds. Lieutenant de la Mestre died on the spot, but Sergeant Ribière was pulled alive from the wreck. Within a few minutes, the Cricket was burning fiercely. Outside Dien Bien Phu, negotiations with the United States for a major bombing operation on the communist siege force around Dien Bien Phu were in the process of bogging down, and General Navarre now began to make plans for a diversionary operation from Laos in the direction of Dien Bien Phu, designed, if unable to break through to the besieged force, at least to divert from it parts of the communist divisions holding the valley. Navarre had decided to entrust that operation to the commander of French forces in Laos, Colonel Boucher de Crèvecœur, an old Indochina hand with almost 20 years' experience in the country. The new task force was to be composed of three battalions reinforced by a series of French commando groups. When Navarre spoke to Crèvecoeur at the southern Laotian airbase of Seno on April 6 at 1300, he harbored few illusions as to the ultimate success of the operation, but he ordered its beginning as of April 13th. Its code name was to be Condor. Crèvecoeur, by the way, translates into English as Heartbreak. On April 7th, the unnatural calm at Dien Bien Phu continued. More and more trenches now appeared around Isabel. These had to be cleared again in a costly hand-to-hand counterattack beyond Isabel V. On Huguette II, another minor disaster occurred in the form of the desertion of what was left of Captain Guilleminot's 12th Company of 3rd BT. Guilleminot had been wounded a few days before, after which the tribesmen felt their bond of fidelity to the French had been severed. To them, war was a very personal affair. They were fighting for Guilleminot, not for some abstract government in Saigon, a city of which they had never heard, or the abstraction of a struggle between the free world and communism. Fortunately for the French, H2 was not yet on the firing line, and, while the men deserted with most of their individual weapons, the situation was rapidly taken in hand. Captain Bizarre and his tough little Vietnamese paratroopers of 15 BPVN moved in on the remainder of the company, disarmed it, and sent it to join the rats of the Nam Yum. Those who voluntarily stayed on were transferred to the artillery. Interspersed with the African gun crews, they could do no further harm. At 10:50, de Castri sent a brief personal query to Hanoi. "I've got 60 communist wounded on my hands. Can I give them back to the enemy?" Indeed, the problem of the communist wounded in French hands was an additional cross which the garrison had to bear. Contrary to the practices of 1961 to 1967, in which both sides acted as if there were no rules of warfare and conventions on the treatment of prisoners, both the French and the Viet Minh made some effort at fighting the war within at least a few humanitarian rules. Hence, Hanoi had no objections to de Castries addressing a radio message to the other side with the following text. "To the commander of the People's Army Siege Force, we inform you that 20 of your wounded will be brought on stretchers to Bon Bon tonight at 2200. The men who will bring them shall not be armed. No action or firing shall take place in that zone until midnight." The exchange took place. As the French stretcher-bearers, led by a master sergeant, arrived at Bon Bon, there was a group of Viet Minh stretcher-bearers standing there in complete silence. Without exchanging a single word with the French, the Viet Minh picked up their wounded and disappeared in the night. In view of this experience, on April 9th, de Castri sent a captured Viet Minh officer with a white flag at the head of a small truck convoy with the remaining communist wounded. The convoy entered enemy lines 800 meters south of E2. The Viet Minh officer was let through by the enemy outpost, but the French medics and their wounded charges were left to wait in the open, untouched and in silence. When the Viet Minh officer failed to return, and it became clear that no one on the communist side was going to make a gesture to take over the wounded, the French also returned to their lines. Later that night, a radio message arrived from the enemy side. "We have received your message concerning the wounded. We are awaiting instructions from higher up and hope to be able to give you tomorrow an exact hour for the meeting. The commander, People's Army Regiment East of Dien Bien Phu." The Viet Minh command proposed an exchange of wounded, with the French wounded to be left 2 kilometers north of Dominique, while the communist prisoners would be brought through south of Claudine. The return of the French wounded to Dien Bien Phu, while in human terms unrefusable, would of course have cancelled out whatever alleviation of the overcrowded hospitals inside the besieged fortress had been hoped for. Still, it had to be accepted. After the French counterattack on E1 of April 10th, however, the Viet Minh High Command informed de Castri curtly that further exchanges would not take place. According to the recollection of Long Le, it was de Castri who finally decided against an alternative, simply to leave the communist wounded at a given point in the no man's land, for fear that the communists would deliberately leave them to die unattended. Either way, to be wounded at Dien Bien Phu was an unenviable fate. On the communist side, the wounded faced days of portage and scant medical care. The Viet Minh had only one full-fledged surgeon, Dr. Thun That Thung, and 6 not too well-informed medical practitioners to take care of the needs of almost 50,000 men. On the French side, there were 19 doctors and facilities for surprisingly excellent surgery, but the wounded had to face an indefinite stay under fire in an underground dugout, with the chance of being killed or wounded by communist shells while lying in the hospital. On April 8, Captain Bizar and his small company from the 5th BPBN once more returned to H6 in order to relieve Captain Minot and his mixed company from the 2-1 RCP. Minot and almost all the other company officers of the 2-1 RCP, Lieutenants Subregy from the 4th Company, Chardigny from the 2nd, and Reuter from the 3rd, had been wounded during the counterattack of April 5th. Minot, however, had remained at his post. Bizard's small band was reinforced during the day by another ragtag company, assembled from units of the 1-2 REI, under the command of Lieutenant Francois. Yet the Viet Minh seemed to have tired of frontal attacks on H6. Instead, the aerial photographs dropped the following day disclosed that the enemy was driving a prong of trenches around either side of H6, with the obvious intent of choking off the position. The initiative for the next round of the battle did not belong to the Viet Minh, but rather to the indomitable Major Bizar. In view of the garrison's unexpected survival of the Battle of the Five Hills and the Huguettes, General Coigny now agreed to parachute into Dien Bien Phu yet another paratroop battalion, but not until he apparently once more tried to substitute some of his less desirable Vietnamese troops for the remaining elite paratroops. De Castries, or Long Le, over De Castries' signature, had fired off a curt telegram directly to Navarre at 09:25 of April 9th, with the following text: "Want the 2nd Foreign Legion Parachute Battalion you promised, and not 1st Vietnamese Parachute Battalion. Prevent that swindle." It is rumored that the two battalion commanders had drawn lots for the honor of jumping into Dien Bien Phu first. Major Hubert Liesenfeldt of the 2nd Foreign Legion Parachute Battalion, BEP, won. Assured of replacements, on April 6th, Bizar made the decision to retake Elian 1. With E1 in the hands of the Viet Minh, the other hill positions were almost untenable. No one could move on E4 without being immediately shot at by elite marksmen installed on E1. Even rifle grenades landed in the trenches day and night. Bizar, his men from the 6th BPC, and one company of 5th BPBN lived like troglodytes in narrow grottos and tomb-like burrows. On the evening of April 8th, Long Le approved Bizar's plan. Anticipating the approval of his senior commander, Bizar, copying the methods of the enemy, had had his men dig approach trenches at night from E4 in the direction of E1. In order not to give away the impending attack, Bizar decided to begin the artillery preparation with the battalion's own 81mm mortars and the 120s of Lieutenant Allaire. In addition, every available 105mm howitzer in all of Dien Bien Phu, 12 in Dien Bien Phu proper and 8 at Isabelle, would open fire on E1, delivering 1,800 rounds in 10 minutes. The mortars would fire a rolling barrage 20 meters ahead of the first infantry wave, and the artillery would fire a dangerously close 40 to 100 meters ahead of the French. But this was not all. As soon as the artillery lifted, the remaining 4 tanks, drawn up on the road below E4, would take the hilltop of E1 under direct fire, as would the Quad 50s from Sparrowhawk. Lastly, the 6 machine guns and 12 automatic rifles dug in on neighboring E2 would pin down anything that still moved on top of E1. It was Bizar's intention to husband the manpower he could not afford to lose by high-volume, well-aimed firepower. In fact, the infantry force devoted to the undertaking consisted of what was left of the 6th BPC. This was not much, even though a trickle of parachuted reinforcements had permitted the reconstitution of 3 rifle companies and a headquarters company. Each of those so-called companies numbered only 80 men. Everything depended upon whether Hanoi would deliver the spare paratroop battalion. On April 9th, almost 180 tons of supplies had been dropped over the valley, with only a 10% loss to the enemy. That night, monsoon rains began to interfere with the dropping of the 2nd BEP. Nevertheless, the battalion's 7th and 8th companies and part of headquarters company managed to land inside the fortress without a hitch. They were immediately assigned to D3. The evening before, a small action that had taken place on the airfield indicated the high morale of the garrison. Captain Charneau and his men from the Air Force detachment had mounted a small commando operation across the airfield in order to drag the charred remains of Lieutenant de la Maistre out of the carcass of the downed observation plane in order to give him proper burial. Out to the west, between Claudine and Huguette, the Moroccans were building a new strong point called Lili or Lilian. Claudine I became Lili I, Lili II was entirely new, and Huguette IV became Lili III. Placed under the command of Major Nicolas, it became fully operational by April 14th. At 1800 of April 9th, two hell divers off aircraft carrier Arromanches, piloted by Lieutenant de la Ferrière and Ensign Logier, roared in right on the deck along Road 41, looking for communist supply convoys near the battlefield. The nest of flak machine guns around Beatrice opened up, and its tracers seemed to follow Ensign Logier's airplane almost all the way to the ground. He crashed too far behind the enemy's line to be reached by Charnot or by anyone else. Saturday to Sunday, April 10th to 11th, 1954. The dawn of April 10th witnessed the French assault on Elian 1, exactly as planned by Bijard. Bijard's term, orchestrating an operation, meant exactly that. To direct the attack on E1, Bijard had his men dig a hole on the slope facing the objective, into which he moved half a dozen radio sets, each within reach. There, he would huddle for the next 10 hours, covered with the sand and debris of nearby enemy hits, and playing the whole battle on his radio transmitters as though they were ungodly musical instruments. He listened in on his infantry companies and on their calls to their platoons. He talked to the artillery commander and to the forward air controller, the mortars, and the tanks. Bijard had personally briefed all the company commanders the evening before, Lieutenants Trapp, Lepage, Perret, and Dattin for the infantry and Allaire for the mortars. On returning to their units, they in turn briefed their platoon commanders. H hour was set at 0550. Contrary to established doctrine, Bijard deliberately used commando tactics. The infantry was committed in very small units, advancing as rapidly as possible, leaving enemy pockets that had not been destroyed by the artillery to be mopped up by the second or third commando wave. The solid advantage of this technique, at least in this instance, was that the Viet Minh commander was unable to organize his defensive fires because the French troops were completely intermingled with his own. At 0610, as soon as a series of smoke shells marked the end of the French barrage, Lieutenant Trapp's leading company began climbing the steep slopes of Elian 1, while French dive bombers, right on schedule, began working over the enemy positions to the rear of the Elians and Dominiques, thus sealing off the battlefield completely. Presently, however, the Viet Minh boxed in the French rear with a counter-barrage. Trapp's company was pinned down high up on the western slope of E1. Bijard now committed Lepage's company, along with a flamethrower team and an automatic rifle team. With Lepage also went a new officer, Lieutenant Combonnier, who had been parachuted in on April 8th. The new company cleared the enemy 120mm mortar barrage in long leaps, but with heavy losses. The automatic rifle group was completely annihilated, and Lieutenant Combonnier received a severe head wound. But Lepage and the flamethrower team got through. Within seconds, the western bunker of Elian 1 disappeared in a river of flame, soon followed by a black cloud and the smell of charred human flesh. At 1400, Trapp and Lepage and the survivors of their two companies were on top of E1 and looking down on the east slope in direction of Phony Mountain, where the hell divers from French Navy Squadron 3F were finishing off what was left of the full Viet Minh battalion that had held the hill. At 1600, Bijard replaced his two companies on top of E2 with two fresh companies from Bressignac's 2-1 RCP under the command of Captains Minot and Charles. The new companies were digging frantically into the loose sand on top of E1 when the enemy began to lay down a heavy counter-barrage of mortars and artillery on the strongpoint. When 6th BPC called the roll that evening, its losses had been 13 dead, 26 wounded, including 3 officers, and 10 missing. This represented one-third of the total force committed. There were also 6 Vietnamese paratroopers in the attack, who, having survived the shock of the assault, promptly deserted. The two companies had hardly had time to become acquainted with what was left of the position when an enemy counterattack began at 1845. It was preceded by a violent artillery barrage, not only on E1 itself, but also on the headquarters area and the artillery positions. General Giap was apparently willing to pay the price for E1, a full Viet Minh regiment. The 98th Infantry of the 316th Division, with 3 battalions, was involved from the beginning. Charles and Minot and their small band of defenders were now in an impossible situation. Although fully equipped with automatic weapons, they were incapable of mowing down the onrushing waves of enemy infantry fast enough. By 20:00, the French on E1 were fighting on in isolated small groups as the vanguard of the Viet Minh reached the crest of the hill. Shortly after 21:00, both the company commanders were wounded. This was Minot's second wound in 5 days, and E1 was leaderless. Bijard, who had watched the agony of the position from Eliane 4, decided to make a stand for it. Frantic radio calls went out to the counterattack companies, organized on a standby basis by all the paratroop battalions. The first unit to respond to the call was the 1st BEP, which sent two small companies of 50 men each under Captains Michel Brandon and Lulu Martin into the blazing furnace atop E1. Simultaneously, General Giap threw a 4th Infantry Battalion into the battle. Then something very strange happened. Something which, in the recollection of the thousands of men who heard it that night, had rarely happened before in Indochina. As the 100 legionnaires and French paratroopers stormed across the low saddle between E4 and E1, they began to sing. Some of the French paratroop songs are in fact translations of German paratroop songs, and now, as they stormed forward, the German legionnaires were singing in their grave Teutonic accents, while the French were singing in their own language. For a moment, there seemed to be a brief lull in the battle. Even the enemy seemed to attempt to identify the strange new sound. But the song and singers melted away in the firefight atop Eliane 1, and Bijard decided to throw in the last available ready reserves, 2nd and 3rd Companies, 5th Vietnamese paratroops. This was the same battalion that had covered itself with shame at the ford of Bon Ke Phi on March 15th. Purged of their unreliable elements and reinforced by some of the French cadre left over from the disintegrated Thai battalions, they had given a good account of themselves in the previous battles for Rouget and the Five Hills. Yet somehow they had never again been taken seriously. Now their turn had come to be offered up for sacrifice on Eliane 1. Unflinchingly, the little Vietnamese paratroopers and their French cadres began the climb, and they too sang. In 1954, the Vietnamese army was still a young army. It had flags of its own and a national anthem, but so far no one had yet found the time to provide that army with a rousing marching song that could be shouted at the top of one's lungs, if only to drown out one's fright. But there was one song which was then still in the cultural inventory of every Vietnamese schoolboy, and that was the French national anthem, the Marseillaise. As the Vietnamese paratroopers in turn emerged on the fire-beaten saddle between the hills, there suddenly arose, for the first and last time in the Indochina War, the Marseillaise. It was sung the way it had been written to be sung in the days of the French Revolution, as a battle hymn of the French Republic. It was sung that night on the blood-stained slopes of Hill Eliane 1 by Vietnamese fighting other Vietnamese in the last battle France fought as an Asian power. By midnight, the remnants of the RCP, the Foreign Legion paratroopers, and the Vietnamese had again cleared E1 in hand-to-hand fighting. The Viet Minh began to fall back, stunned. As dawn broke, Bijard fed into E1 the newly arrived 7th Company, 2nd BEP, of Captain de la Fond. The captain had been killed earlier that evening by a communist shell, and the company, now led by Lieutenant Le Coeur Grand Maison, had witnessed the whole battle from its reserve position on Dominique 3. It had also directly witnessed the counterattacks of the 1st BEP and of the 5th BPVN, and knew what to expect. But the enemy fire had slackened off on E1, and the unfolding daylight revealed the shambles of the position. Perhaps 400 communist dead lay intermingled with the heavy casualties of the French. Of the two small companies of the 2-1 RCP, one had ceased to exist, counting 10 dead, 21 missing, and 66 wounded, including Lieutenant Reuter. The 1st BEP and the Vietnamese also had about 100 casualties. Yet they had taken and held E1, and they were going to hold it now grimly for 20 full days and nights of fighting. Companies would stay 48 hours on E1, be bled white, and pulled back for rest. The next company would then be hacked to pieces on top of the hill. The bodies of friend and foe on E1 were covered with a light layer of sand and sandbags and used as revetments, only to be torn up again and again by the incoming shells. The French were to stay on Eliane 1 almost until the end. When E1 finally fell, Dien Bien Phu had only a few days to live. Meanwhile, like the band of brothers in Shakespeare's Henry V, the French paratroopers at Dien Bien Phu had had their St. Crispin's Day. After the successful counterattack on E1, Long Le once more reorganized the defense of Dien Bien Phu. Rank and seniority no longer counted. The only criterion for command responsibility was the net worth of the officer. A number of lieutenant colonels and majors found themselves unemployed or relegated to minor tasks having nothing to do with their rank or past experience. On the other hand, the actual conduct of the battle was now completely in the hands of the paratroop mafia. Long Le divided the whole main position of Dien Bien Phu into 5 quartiers, districts, and assigned one of his most trusted associates to the command of each. Breschignac was named to the command of the 5 hills, Chanel of 2nd BT commanded the lowland areas east of the Nam Yum, Guiraud, though wounded, took command of the northern part of Dien Bien Phu proper, Furet commanded on Sparrowhawk, and Vadeau took over the west and south of Dien Bien Phu. Bijar now officially